Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Science Chicago at the Art Institute of Chicago. Which you may have noticed, it's a citywide project to bring the sciences into higher relief, and we're big enough here to be able to share the stage with the sciences. It's actually a very exciting opportunity for the Art Institute to look at the science behind the art, and we've been fortunate enough in our very generous and talented conservation scientists have given some really remarkable presentations. I'm thrilled to be able to introduce Inga Fiedler to you today. She has been a colleague for many years and it knows the Syrah specifically more intimately than any one of us can ever hope to do. Inga is a conservation microscopist in the conservation department, and she's been in this position since 1979. Her training in painting conservation and microanalytical techniques was undertaken in the conservation department here, supplemented with specialized courses in optical microscopy, chemical microscopy, instrumental analysis, and chemistry, taught at the McCrone Research Institute at IIT and Roosevelt University in Chicago. She has an MFA in studio art, so she knows not only whereof she speaks, but is also an artist herself. Her BFA in studio art was granted by the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. While she is concentrated primarily on the research of painting materials with a particular interest in 19th century materials, she's also co-authored two chapters on artists' pigments in the Artists' Pigment Handbook, a series which is sponsored or published by the National Gallery in Washington. And she's the co-author of essays in the Art Institute's Museum Studies issue on conservation. If you saw our Syrah show a number of years ago now, you may have had the opportunity to read her chapter. Much of that research will be highlighted in today's talk. Presently, she's working on Bathers by a River, the Grand Matisse painting, which will be the centerpiece of a Matisse exhibition in 2010. And as well, she's engaged with the Van Gogh Museum to do research on the three different versions of Bedroom at Arles, one of which is part of our permanent collection. After having taken a moment to turn off all pagers, telephones, and other musical instruments which you may be carrying, I hope you will join me, please, in welcoming Inga Fiedler.
Thank you. Welcome. Get settled here. In preparation for the exhibition, Syrah and the Making of the Grand Jatte, held at the Art Institute in 2004, research was conducted by several staff members in the museum's conservation department that included conservators Frank Zuccari and Allison Langley, who primarily focused on the many compositional changes that occurred in the work. Francesca Casadia, conservation scientist, assisted us on the... Can you hear me?
No.
How's that? Better?
Yes.
Okay. Francesca Casadia, conservation scientist, assisted us on the color science research, and I mainly focused on the investigating the artist's painting materials and his technique. Color scientist Roy Burns of the Munzel Color Science Lab at Rochester Institute of Technology worked with us and the imaging department here at the museum on digitally rejuvenating the painting. The exhibition provided us with an opportunity to re-examine Syrah's Le Grand Jatte, making use of technical advances that were not available when the painting last underwent extensive technical analysis in 1982. At that time, we were asked to investigate the painting materials used to create his most famous work and to study the artist's technique. We also hoped to elucidate the types of unstable pigments that Syrah was reported to have been used. The research took about 2 years to complete, and much of the findings corroborated what had been recorded in the literature, including Syrah's own account of the sequence in which he painted the Grand Jatte. For the research conducted for this current exhibition, a variety of other investigative methods were employed, to provide us with new information of Seurat's masterwork. Infrared reflectograms of the entire painting were captured directly into a computer and composited digitally. The 57 separate sheets of X-rays taken in 1982 were scanned and, with the aid of a computer, composited as well. Additional paint samples, including cross sections, were taken to better understand the artist's technique, and binding medium analysis on a select number of samples was also conducted. In addition, high-resolution images were taken of the entire painting, and spectrophotometry allowed for accurate reflectance measurements of a range of colors, including the discolored paint. I am now going to summarize what our combined research disclosed of this famous work. Georges Seurat's A Sunday on Le Grand Jatte, 1884, is the result of a long involved working process that occupied the artist over a course of many years. Seurat was both systematic and intuitive in his development of the large canvas. In the academic tradition, he used more than 50 studies to develop and enlarge the composition, yet he continually made refinements on the Grand Jatte as the Grand Jatte progressed, altering the forms of his figures and modifying his painting technique in response to new artistic theories. Seurat began the painting in May 1884 in preparation for a March 1885 exhibition of the Society of Independent Artists. Initially working outside on the island during the summer and fall of 1884, Seurat painted studies on thin portable wooden panels measuring approximately 6 by 9 inches. On these, he experimented with the placement, poses, and groupings of many of the figures within the landscape setting. 6 of the studies can be seen here. During the winter, he worked in his studio, still painting on small wood panels, but also using larger painted image canvases and drawings on paper to further refine the composition. As he worked, the studies became gradually larger in scale. Most of the drawings appear to have been done at a late stage in the planning process, after the painted studies. The simplified tonal studies often bear a very close resemblance to the final forms of the Grand Jatte, and a number of the drawn figures are close in scale to the figures that we see in the painting. As the Grand Jatte neared completion in March 1885, the exhibition for which it was prepared was canceled, and Seurat set aside the large canvas for several months. When he returned to the painting in the fall of 1885, Seurat began a second painting campaign using a brighter, refined palette and a new painting technique with which he had been experimenting with over the summer. Between October and March, he reworked much of the composition using small dabs, dashes, and lines of paint, changing the surface character of the painting, adjusting the color relationships, and expanding many of the figural forms. The Grand Jatte debuted at the May 1886 eighth and final Impressionist exhibition. Seurat's work on the canvas was not yet completed, however, and he returned to it in a third painting campaign in 1888-1889 when he added the painted border. Amongst our many tools that used to examine a work of art are the different forms of visible and invisible light, represented in this diagram of the electromagnetic spectrum arranged by wavelength. Using X-ray wavelengths, we were able to look through the paint from the wood and canvas supports to the topmost paint layer, revealing the artist's working process. Infrared reflectography employs a camera equipped with an infrared sensitive detector to capture reflected IR energy And this energy is then converted to a visible image that can be recorded digitally or on film. IR penetrates through the upper layers of the painting and allows us to see underdrawing and early paint layers. Examining the surface of the painting with magnification using a low-power microscope and analyzing paint samples with optical microscopy and scanning electron microscopy, we were able to gain an intimate knowledge of the artist's material. And finally, reflectance measurements of the colors on the surface of the painting helped us visualize the changes the painting has undergone over time. These two landscape studies represent the stage set upon which Seurat would place the figures. The painted landscape from a private collection may in fact have served a practical function as a canvas which Seurat could hold up the smaller painted panels to test figural arrangements. Finished in December 1884, the painted landscape nearly depicts the final appearance of the island. However, it is squarer in format than either the Grand Jatte or the early panel paintings. For many of the studies, the final 2x3 meter canvas, Seurat used a 2-to-3 height to width ratio, which is apparent in the drawn landscape. Completed after the painted version, the drawing shows Seurat revising the view of the island, essentially cropping the top and bottom of the scene to create the landscape view that would remain constant from this point forward. The large painted sketch from the Metropolitan Museum of Art was a departure point for the final canvas. It measures exactly 1/3 the size of the Grand Jatte and also fits the 2-to-3 proportion. In this study, Seurat appears to have modified a larger canvas to fit the proportion. He originally left the top and bottom strips of a 73-by-100-centimeter canvas exposed in order to make the painted image fit to a 66-by-100-centimeter image size. The painted edges you see now were added later. The Metropolitan painting is one of three studies with evidence of a grid system that Seurat used to enlarge and transfer the composition. The grid under the paint was discovered by examination with an infrared camera, which delineated the set grid lines dividing the canvas into rectangular quarters and square sixths. The presence of the grid lines under the paint implies that the design was transferred from another source. This sketch, formerly in the collection of the artist Paul Signac, which was lost in World War II, may possibly be the source that the Met study was transferred from. It has been hypothesized that a grid lies under the paint of the Grand Jatte, but we only recently found physical evidence to support this theory. A series of marks and tack holes corresponding to a grid were found along the edges of the painting. The marks appear to have been incised into the ground layer and then coated with a red pigmented material, as you can see here in this detail. A small portion of a horizontal red line was found in the thinly painted reeds at the left edge of the painting, suggesting that more lines may be present under the surface. Infrared reflectography has been used several times unsuccessfully to try to find a grid beneath the paint. However, infrared typically detects graphite and other carbon-based materials that absorb in the infrared region. Colored underdrawing materials such as the red paint or chalk used on the Grand Jatte are generally not detectable. When marks at the edges of the grandjat are connected, a square grid emerges that divides the composition evenly into 24 squares of 1/2 meter each. The uniform sections would not only have provided a system for enlargement and transfer, but the vertical lines may have served as axes for positioning significant compositional features. And it should also be noted that the markings were found along three sides at the original turnover edge of the painting before Seurat expanded the work and added the border. There is also evidence of a grid on the couple from the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, England, as well as hatch marks along the edges of the drawing of the same subject from the British Museum. The grid structures on these two studies of the right half of the composition corresponds almost exactly to the squared grid of the grandjat. The painted study has tacks and lines on the edges of the painting that line up with the drawn grid that lies under the paint. In this case, the paint is so thinly and loosely applied that the grid is visible to the naked eye. The tacks on the edges may have served to stretch string across the surface of the painting to facilitate drawing of the lines. It is also likely that string may have been used after the painting was finished to provide a three-dimensional grid that Seurat could use to transfer the composition to the final painting. The late studies with the grids are particularly important in the information they provide about Seurat's working process. The Metropolitan Study, which we believe to be the earliest of the three, has a dark tonality similar to the wood panels. The painted couple most likely served as a later color study for the final painting. It has a similar off-white ground and may have been a test canvas for laying in the colors. The drawn couple, like many of the other drawings, works as a tonal study. Its close resemblance to the final forms on the grandjat indicates that it was probably created at a later stage than the other works. Looking at these works together, one can see the many little changes Seurat made to the composition. For example, the promenading man carries an umbrella pointed down to the ground in the painted couple. The umbrella is seemingly absent from the three other works, yet examination of the Metropolitan's painting surface and x-ray reveals that the umbrella was once in this composition as well, but was later painted over. Seurat made modifications to the Metropolitan study, most of which correspond to changes on the grandjat, indicating that he continued to work on the Metropolitan canvas as he painted our painting as well. Many other modifications are more obvious upon examination of the Metropolitan study and the final painting. The little white dog in the background, for example, hope you can see it, moves from one side of the tree to the other. The boatman in the lower left corner loses his sleeve in the final painting, and his companion gains a top hat and a cane. The woman fishing is larger in scale in the final painting, and her companion is turned slightly toward the viewer. Also on the final canvas, a small leaping dog takes a place in the foreground, joining the monkey. Interestingly, there are no known drawn or painted studies of this dog. However, it is well defined in the x-ray, although it is totally absent in the Metropolitan study. X-rays of the grandjat provide us with a unique glimpse of how the artist worked on the canvas. When a painting is x-rayed, the x-rays are absorbed in variable amounts by all the layers of the painting. Pigments which contain elements with a higher atomic number, such as lead white or lead-containing pigments, for instance, appear light in the x-rays. Thus, areas such as the sunlit grass, the little girl in white in the center, and the horizontal wall and sailboat in the background appear white in the x-ray. Wooden stretcher bars and nails at the edges of the painting absorb differently from the painted canvas, resulting in the patterns visible around the edges. And the lines in the center of the painting are also seen. Since paint thickness affects absorption, the X-ray reveals the order in which Seurat added the different compositional elements to the canvas, as well as artist changes. Seurat began by painting the landscape, including the trees and shadows, and the large figural forms in the foreground, highlighted here in blue. These areas appear dark in the X-ray, indicating that Seurat reserved space for them from the outset. At an intermediate stage in painting, he added the figures positioned further back in the landscape, highlighted here in green. In the X-ray, we can see the shadows and landscape forms running through these figures. At a later stage in painting, Seurat added the figures highlighted in red. The figures at the shoreline are painted over the completed water. And one surprising find was the late addition of the monkey, which appears to be painted over the finished grass. If you look closely at the painting, you will be able to see that it is quite clearly painted over the shoes and skirt of the promenading woman. While the overall arrangement of most of the forms was established from the beginning and remained constant, Seurat made numerous modifications. By looking at specific figural groups in the X-ray, we can see how the artist progressively altered the contours of the forms as he painted. On the left is a detail of the promenading group, and at the right, an X-ray of the same area. The skirt of the promenading woman had at least two distinct shapes before March 1885, predating Seurat's revision of the painting with dots, dashes, and lines. Originally, the woman's form was slimmer, with a thin waist and a straight skirt with a sharply sloping bustle. Here, the red line indicates the first form visible in the X-ray. As the painting progressed, Seurat widened the skirt, adding a protruding rear bustle, internal folds and definition, and raising the hem. At the same time, he appears to have widened her companion's form as well. Here, the blue line indicates an intermediate painted form visible in the X-ray. During the second campaign, the skirt changed once again. Seurat widened the skirt, further exaggerating the bustle. An outline of the final painted form is delineated with the green line. Note on the right side of the form that the skirt extends over portions of the landscape. The horizontal band at the bottom of the skirt was left undisturbed, giving an idea of the garment's width before Seurat added the final flared back. These are examples of the painted and drawn studies of the promenading woman, suggesting that Seurat experimented with a number of skirt fashions as he conceived the figure. These are two studies representing skirts with internal folds and forms that may relate to the intermediate addition we see in the X-ray. Seurat's modifications to the figures of the mother and child from the center of the Grand Jatte are also evident in a number of the early panels. They appear separately and together. Seurat appears to have debated their placement on the landscape, and at one point, the mother's figure is reversed, her right hand holding the parasol instead of the left. That's in the panel in the middle. On the left is a detail of the mother and child from the center of the painting, and on the right is the X-ray of the figures. The initial painted form of the mother seen in the X-ray, highlighted here in red, was significantly narrower and straighter. Her skirt was longer and cast a short shadow to the right. The mother and child originally looked much more like the figures in the Metropolitan study, seen here on the right side. The little girl's hat and dress differ, but her arm extends up toward her mother's in both works. Only later did the forms take on their final appearance. When Seurat reworked the canvas, he widened the mother's form, particularly on the right side, and raised the hem of her skirt. The green line indicates the final painted form. He modified the girl's arm, making it extend horizontally. Additionally, he extended the shadow underneath the forms, creating the peculiar illusion that the mother is floating above the ground. These changes, visible in the X-ray, are also visible on the surface of the Grand Jatte. As already mentioned, Seurat painted the Grand Jatte in three separate campaigns. I am now going to give you a closer look at the paint surface and describe the different paint applications and painting materials Seurat used in the three campaigns. This detail of the couple that we saw earlier in the Fitzwilliam Museum shows how Seurat initially roughly blocked in the composition using thin, broad, rectangular brushstrokes. Much of the priming layer was left uncovered and is readily visible between the brushwork. And you can see the sort of the white showing through. Based on microscopic examination of the Grand Jatte, it is believed that Seurat used a similar technique for blocking in the overall composition. Seurat painted the Grand Jatte on a fairly coarse linen canvas that was commercially primed with a lead white ground tinted with a small amount of carbon black. And this resulted in an off-white color. Because of the large size of the canvas, Seurat probably had to order a special oversized fabric. The combination of a fairly coarsely woven canvas and thin ground created a grainy texture that is discernible through the paint layers. There are two paint losses, one below the black dog near its hind paw and the other on the edge of the woman's skirt in this detail of the foreground in the shadowed grass area. These small losses show the underlying paint layers that can also be seen in the paint cross-section on the right. This cross-section, taken in the area of the loss under the dog, where you see where the arrow is, shows a fairly complex paint layering. The thick greenish-yellow bottom layer corresponds to the underlayer used to roughly sketch in the composition. Above this layer are a series of paint layers. There is a very thin yellow-green layer, barely discernible, just above the underlayer. And above that is a fairly thick, uneven layer of a mixture of predominantly cobalt blue. Then there are alternating thin layers of yellow-green and a deep red lake. And on top of that, another blue layer is followed by a lighter green layer, upper green layer, consisting of mainly emerald green. Paintings are sampled under a low-power microscope using surgical tools. A small paint fragment is removed and mounted in a liquid polyester resin that, when mixed together with a catalyst, hardens after several days. Once hardened, the sample is then ground and polished to reveal the edge of the paint fragment, allowing us to examine or analyze the layers of paint by reflected light microscopy or scanning electron microscopy. Seurat's technique when he first worked on the picture was similar to that of the Impressionists. The technique also bears resemblance to his first major composition, Bathing Place, in the collection of the National Gallery. The upper left section of the Grand Jatte is a good example of mainly early campaign features with minimal additions from subsequent paint applications. As mentioned, Seurat's technique is similar to the Impressionist, except that he rendered his subject matter more precisely and systematically. His brushwork varied according to the types of forms he was depicting. Most of the foliage and grass was painted in short crisscross brushwork. The water was painted in short, disconnected horizontal bands, and the sky and the embankment were more blended together. He used short, vertical, multicolored lines to depict tree trunks and parasols, and the figures and animals were painted with a combination of ellipses, broken lines, and slashes. In October 1885, Seurat resumed work on the Grand Jatte, incorporating his new divisionist technique based on his recently developed color concepts, which he had first applied to pictures during that summer in Grand Camp. Seurat reworked most of the canvas, applying additional paint over existing layers using small, brightly colored brush strokes in the form of dots, dashes, and lines. He also revised his palette to conform to his newly devised technique. Although the grid markings and possible grid lines were not detected by infrared reflectography, this technique does clearly show Seurat's painting method and the subsequent changes he made to the painting's composition. IR emphasizes the different types of brushwork Seurat employed, which can be seen in these details I'm going to show you. The brushwork, as you can see, is mostly directional, following the contour shapes of the figures, their clothing, and their accessories. The small circular dot-like brushwork is also very evident, as is the cross-hatching and the vertical and horizontal linear brushwork. These details of the seated woman and young girl at the far right shows an area of paint loss in the skirt of the woman with the yellow and blue bonnet, and reveals the yellow-green underlayer used by Seurat to lay out his composition. This thin yellow-green layer is also seen in the paint cross-section taken from within the loss area. The very thin yellowish-green layer is seen just above a thick bottom layer of the lead-white ground. And as mentioned, Seurat enlarged the main figures during the second campaign, and the paint loss in the sunlit grass and the skirt of the seated woman shows the extension of the skirt over the landscape. This cross-section is also a good example showing the complexity of the artist's technique and how he built up his paint layers. This is another example of Seurat's second campaign, where he altered or changed the silhouettes of many of the main figures. In this detail of the central woman, the additions are visible on both sides of the figure. Seurat increased the width of the woman's arms as well as her skirt using multicolored dots. With the reworking, he did not attempt to completely cover over the underlying paint layers, and the lighter yellow-green of the grass and the white parasol shows through between the brushwork. He also did not attempt to completely match the existing colors with the additions, having a somewhat different pigment composition in addition to being lighter in tone. Another feature that Seurat incorporated in his second campaign was the use of pink outlines, which is one of the few continuous linear features seen in this work. Although the majority of these lines were done in pink, some were also painted in blue. These lines were then partly covered by regularly spaced blue, green, and pink dots, as can be seen in this detail of the couple and the baby in the background. The research of color scientist M. Chevreul and his theories on simultaneous contrast of colors was a major influence on Seurat. Simultaneous contrast of color is achieved by placing complementary colors side by side, thus exaggerating their differences and increasing the brilliance of both. The theories of Ogden Rood, an American scientist, were also an important influence on the artist. Rood's book, Modern Chromatics, was translated into French in 1881, and whose color contrast diagram Seurat copied and utilized in his work. This page from Seurat's sketchbook of 1881 shows Root's color contrast diagram that Seurat copied fairly early in his career. This detail of the main promenading couple on the far right illustrates the halo effect based on Chevreul's theories of successive contrast. Successive contrast results from retinal fatigue, in which a complementary afterimage of a color is retained in the eye and creates a momentary complementary halo around objects. The halo is seen as a band of yellow-orange dots following the woman's contours. The next three photomicrographs show some of Seurat's second campaign technique. Seurat expanded the fisherwoman's skirt over the water and added linear contours to the front of her body using thin lines. The underlying first stage of the water can be seen in this detail. Also seen are the small, almost circular-shaped brush strokes of yellow, blue, and pink. This detail was taken from along the lower edge of her skirt on the right side and shows some of the light yellow-green grass from the first campaign that is partially covered over by second campaign brushwork of yellow, blue, and pink. Also seen is the thin pink outlining described earlier. This detail shows how Seurat rendered the shadow under her skirt. The short vertical brush strokes in various shades of pink, red, and yellows are partially covered by second stage dots of various shades of greens and blues. Sometime in 1888 or 1889, Seurat formulated the idea of colored borders and frames and began adding painted edges to his pictures, including many of his earlier works. These additions usually consist of colors approximately complementary to the adjacent area of the painting proper. The purpose was to provide a visual transition between the painting and its frame. In order to achieve this, Seurat restretched the painting, exposing portions of the canvas support that originally was part of the tacking margin. The cross-section taken from an area of the border shows the overlapping paint layers of yellow, reddish-orange, blue, and a lead-white paint layer that Seurat applied to the entire border after restretching and before painting. The brush strokes are much larger and more typical of his later technique. These details show the wider space brushwork that Seurat applied to some sections adjacent to the border within the actual painting. These rather parallel series of larger dots echo the line of the border in the work. Comprised of simpler mixtures, the majority are orange and yellow, and some are also blue and green. The types of pigments found in the Grand Jatte reveal how the work progressed and how the artist's evolving technique reflects contemporary writings and ideas about color. Seurat's palette during 1884-1885 was comprised of prismatic colors, although he continued to use earth colors such as iron oxide yellow and burnt sienna. Trace amounts of black were also found in the paint mixtures. Typically, his pigment mixtures consist of 4 to 5 components to achieve the exact color that he wanted. In contrast, for the reworking, second stage mixtures generally comprised fewer pigments. The effects of divisionism were achieved using spectrally pure hues applied with minimally mixing on the palette. They were applied as small adjacent brush strokes that were to optically fuse together or mix in the viewer's eyes to create the desired vibrancy. Seurat added zinc yellow to his palette, as well as several reds, cadmium, and chrome yellow pigments in more than one hue, thereby increasing the number of pigments used to achieve a closer proximity to the solar spectrum. Seurat's 1891 palette that's now in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris shows an upper row of pigments arranged by hue, a second row where the artist mixed the pigments together with some white or adjacent colors and some white, and a third row of pure white used for additional mixing to lighten his colors. These are some examples of the pigments that Seurat used in the Grand Jatte and were identified by polarized light microscopy. The samples are dispersed in a special permanent mounting medium that enables us to identify them using the microscope. This instrument uses specific interactions with light vibrating in a known direction, thus allowing us to measure the optical and physical characteristics of a specific crystalline material. On the left are examples of the two blues, cobalt and ultramarine. In the middle, the two greens, emerald green and viridian. And on the right, two reds. In this case, the red vermilion is mixed with a chrome yellow to make an orange color. On the bottom right are small flakes of a red lake that was taken from the border. To create a purple color, Seurat used a mixture of ultramarine blue and red lake, as you can see in the bottom left image. Zinc yellow, specifically zinc potassium chromate, was one of the pigments Seurat added to his palette during the reworking of the Grand Jatte. Samples of zinc yellow are seen here in these three photomicrographs. It was not widely used and was certainly not as popular as the various shades of chrome yellow. Also of particular interest is that the zinc yellow used by Seurat was mixed with starch grains. These are seen as transparent, clear, irregular-shaped grains in the upper left view, and as pale white with characteristic crosses in the fully cross-polar's view on the right side. This starch was most likely added as an extender or paint modifier. A test for starch was conducted using iodine complex formation, which turned the starch first to a purple color and then later a darker brownish color, as can be seen in the bottom image. Instrumental analysis was also conducted to confirm and further chemically characterize many of the pigments used, including the zinc yellow. Elemental analysis such as scanning electron microscopy with energy dispersive X-ray spectroscopy, also referred to as SEMEDS, was used to analyze all of the cross sections that were taken. A sample of the foliage from the trees was examined by reflected light microscopy, as you see on the right, and then analyzed by SEMEDS. And the same sample can be seen in a backscatter electron view. The starch grains in the upper zinc yellow layer, seen as dark, irregular-shaped particles in the upper layer, are clearly visible. The results obtained from the analysis, The results obtained from the SEM analysis are shown on the spectrum, and one can see the lines for the elements chromium, zinc, potassium, lead, and barium. In addition to elemental characterization, zinc yellow was also analyzed by Raman microscopy, and the instrument is, you can see on the left view. This instrument gives the molecular structure of the material, the results of which are seen in the spectra on the right side. The spectrum obtained for the discolored zinc yellow from the Grand Jatte is seen on top and can be compared to a zinc yellow reference sample directly below. I don't know if you can see that very well, but they do match up pretty well. To summarize, zinc yellow, the pigment zinc yellow, was first it first became available commercially in 1847. It was not as popular as chrome or cadmium yellows, and even though it was listed as being perfectly good to use by some scientists, it is not very light fast and is apt to turn grayish green owing to the formation of chromic oxide. In addition to being used as an artist pigment, it was also used extensively as a corrosion-resistant primer. In a review of Seurat's memorial exhibition from 1892, Fénion had this to say of the Grand Jatte, and I quote, "Because of the colors which Seurat used toward the end of 1885 and 1886, this painting of historical importance has lost its luminous charm. While the reds and blues are preserved, the Veronese greens are now olive greenish, and the orange tone which represented light now represent nothing but holes." I just want to mention that Veronese green is the sort of French term for emerald green. Zinc yellow was also found used in these two works. One, the first painting, the Bathers, at the National Gallery, and in the collection of the Courtauld, this landscape. As mentioned, one of the objectives of the 1982 investigations was to determine if there were any color changes, as noted by Fénion and others when they saw the painting in 1892. It was determined that, yes, the color changes did indeed occur, and it was further determined that zinc yellow was the main cause of the discoloration, adversely affecting all the colors mixed with the pigment. Brush strokes composed mainly of zinc yellow, which were originally a bright yellow, have become a yellow-brown similar to a yellow ochre color. Zinc yellow mixed with vermilion, which had been orange, has turned to a warm brown. And the yellow-green dots, composed mainly of zinc yellow and emerald green, have shifted to an olive green, as can be seen here in these details from the painting. I'm also including an example of modern-day emerald green and zinc yellow to show what the actual colors look like. When these dry powdered pigments are mixed with an oil medium, they do become darker. However, not to the extent that we see in the painting. As mentioned in the introduction, another objective for the exhibition was to try and reconstruct digitally the discolored areas of the painting. To this end, non-destructive color measurements were made with a portable visible spectrophotometer that measures the spectral reflectance for each color. A spectrophotometer measures the amount of light reflected from an object relative to the amount of incident light as a function of wavelength. Roy Burns and Francesca Casadio took spectral reflectance measurements of over 50 locations across the painting on two separate occasions. Roy is seen here, well, part of Roy is seen here, taking in situ measurements of the Grand Jatte in the conservation studio. These details I'm going to show you show examples of the discolored yellow, green, and orange dots that were measured. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go into specific details on the exact methodology Burns used to come up with his results, but he was able to calculate the differences between the aged and unaged zinc yellow measurements to establish an approximate numerical color value of the zinc yellow, and also for each type of zinc yellow mixture, the yellow, orange, and green that Sorrell might have used. Based on his measurements, Burns was able to calculate a numerical color value that could be used with Adobe Photoshop mapping software to rejuvenate or recolor a digital image of the painting. The Art Institute's imaging department, working with the conservators and Burns, worked for months hand-selecting individual brush strokes on a one-to-one digital image to produce the final full-size printed reproduction of the rejuvenated Le Grand Jatte that was shown in the exhibition. These are some details showing the Grand Jatte before and after digital rejuvenation. The brush strokes that Fenillon had described as holes in the sunlit grass, appearing as a strong speckled pattern, have now blended together with the background, color. The resulting digital reproduction of the Grand Jatte is an approximation of what the painting may have looked like in the 1880s. The painting appears more luminous overall, particularly in the sunlit grass. I just would like to conclude that despite the inalterable changes that occurred on a number of the colors Seurat used to create the Grand Jatte, it is nevertheless a testimony to the strength of Seurat's ideas and the mastery of his technique that the painting remains the vibrant work of art it is. I just would like to thank my colleagues who contributed to this research and to the lecture. And I also would like to urge you to go upstairs and to see the actual painting, because I think this will make more sense to you. Thank you very much.